Streaming on the Civic Media app.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the
same... ABC News, I'm Andy Field. A structural engineer report issued days before an apartment building partially collapsed in Davenport, Iowa, indicated that a wall of the structure was at imminent risk of crumbling. The director of development and neighborhood services, Richard Oswald, says the building was deemed livable.
At the time and the information we had, based on the engineering reports from Select Structural, there was no cause to think they shouldn't be. So that was why that permit was issued for that repair work to be done.
At least two victims still unaccounted for. Pentagon has told Nevada's Nellis Air Force Base that a previously approved drag show scheduled for tonight has been canceled because it is not in line with Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's recent comments. Voting underway in the Senate on amendments to a bill to raise the debt ceiling.
Default is not an option, and that means we have to pass this bill.
Senator Dick Durbin says time's running out. They're considering at least 11 amendments. This is ABC News. Average long-term mortgage rates have climbed to 6.79%. That's the highest level since November. The 2023 Atlantic hurricane season officially underway, and already there is a contender for the first named storm, Arlene. The Supreme Court rules in favor of a concrete company in a labor relations case.
In this case, a strike by truckers ended up destroying property. Truck drivers for Glacier Northwest, a Washington State concrete company, went on strike with concrete still inside their mixing trucks. The company sued, saying it had to throw away the unused concrete at a financial loss. The Washington State Supreme Court ruled in favor of the truckers' union, arguing what happened was protected under federal labor laws. But in an 8-1 decision, the Supreme Court reversed that ruling. Lindsay Watts, ABC News, Washington.
Boeing signing a deal with Los Angeles-based startup to buy hydrogen that will be produced by facilities designed to get carbon dioxide out of seawater. Andy Field, ABC News.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Mantner. Here's what you need to know. The U.S. Department of Justice is now involved in the land dispute in Vilas County between the town of Lac des Flambeaux and the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. The Department of Justice sued, saying the town's roads trespass on tribal land. The lawsuit seeking relief and damages for the tribe and affected landowners for the town's, quote, intentional and unauthorized use and occupancy of land that's part of the town's road system, unquote. The town says they're working with the tribal council to try and find a resolution. Five people ranging in age from 18 to 48 have been arrested in connection with an Amber Alert issued on Wednesday for one-year-old Kennedy Parker. Milwaukee police said a little girl was found safe. Charges will be referred to the DA's office. I'm Jane Mantner. This is Civic Media News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
UPS Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight.
The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
Do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, we come to you from Flint, Michigan. Yesterday, spent some time in Hamtramck. And again, one of my favorite words to say is had a great time at Baker's Bar and Lounge there in Hamtramck. And if you missed that show, make sure you go back and check it out. Find the podcast wherever you find your favorite podcast. You will find it there. Had a great time talking with the folks from One Fair Wage. The idea that maybe people should be able to earn a living off of what they do. Maybe work should pay. Maybe there should be a reward for work. I know, bridge too far for some. But we're in this moment. We're in a moment right now with the idea of talking about restoring prosperity to the working class. And as I've been saying, I think the Biden administration is moving us in a very positive direction. But had a great conversation with Andy Levin, the representative in the area, who came out to how often do you get a congressman to show up at a neighborhood bar and everybody know his name? It was kind of like a Cheers moment where, you know, he walked in, everybody knew him, he knew them. This is how politics are supposed to be. This is participatory democracy. This is people engaged in the political process. And as we talked about on the show yesterday, the idea being, you know, putting back that reward to work, reviving, re-energizing, re-engaging, reuniting the working class to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. That is a nonpartisan issue, in my view. Should not be partisan at all. But yet, and I look here in the state of Michigan, where the shenanigans that the Republicans played when the fight for 15, when the fight to end the sub-minimum wage was going on, they did something really backdoorish. They went and they passed the law saying, yeah, we're going to do that. And then they gutted it. I mean, it's what I expect because, again, I come back to the frame, Republicans hate working people. That is the constant theme that we keep coming across. Wish it weren't true. And I know I've got a lot of working class friends who are Republicans or think they are. Understand, in this moment, the current Republican Party hates working people. So please, if you are still in that camp, maybe think about how to bring your party back to some bit of reality, some bit of sanity, some bit of a willingness to fight and push and make workers' lives better. Because at the end of this, and I keep saying this often, and it's part of what the conversations we had yesterday on the program were about, is, you know, how do we make sure that we make lives better? I don't care if you wear a red hat or a blue hat. I want to make lives better. And, you know, the thing with Andy that got my attention is, you know, as someone who is a truck driver most of my working life, the fact that he cared about the trucking industry in a way that politicians haven't for a very long time. And part of the reason that we're doing this Working Class Heroes radio tour, the reason that we're out here talking to people and gathering stories, is exactly what Andy Levin was talking about. You know, in the trucking industry, and I've been saying this for years, truck drivers have been basically screwed over as the unions have lost their power, as deregulation has taken hold, and we've created this gig economy, hey, you're your own boss, independent contractor nonsense. What's happened is a handful of people have gotten wildly wealthy, and the working people have continued to get the short end of the stick. And what Andy was talking about in his legislation, which, you know, I hope now that we find out that there is a companion bill in the Senate to bring overtime to the trucking industry, because if you remember, go back into the 1930s, truck drivers were exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act. Understand, they're only getting paid when those wheels are turning, unless, like me, they have a union contract that negotiates what they get compensated for their time. And this is, again, another one of those moments where you go, this is another reason every truck driver should be in a union, without question. But you look at the moment we're in. We keep hearing, oh, we've got supply chain issues. Oh, there's a truck driver shortage. And I've been arguing there's not a shortage. There's a shortage of good-paying jobs. There's a shortage of companies that treat their employees well. And there's a shortage of using their labor in the most efficient way possible. While they were showing all the ships being lined up out in the ports and all the stacked up containers that were being ready to be driven out and all this stuff, they didn't show you the lines of tractors waiting for loads, because the brokers didn't care about wasting their time. I think Levin's bill, and this is why I think, you know, having people like Andy Levin in Congress is so important, they would be getting paid to sit there. Currently, they can sit there for days and no one has to compensate them for their time. Put it on the backs of the companies that abuse their labor right now. Put it on the backs of the people who benefit from them being the workforce reserve. Make them pay them to sit there. And I guarantee you those guys will be running. They'll be rolling tomorrow. They won't waste a minute. Because I'll tell you, I've been in the unionized trucking industry my entire working life. They don't let you sit around waiting. If they're paying you, they want you moving. They want you working. There's an incentive for them. And it only makes sense that if there's no cost to wasting your time, if there's no penalty to waste your time, they're going to waste your time. Doesn't that make sense at a certain level? Of course it does. And this is one of those moments where I keep coming back to. Doesn't matter which hat you wore in the last election. Doesn't matter who you voted for. Doesn't matter which team you're rooting for. All of us should say, you know what? If you show up, you go to work, you should get paid. All of us should be saying that if you work hard, you play by the rules, you should get ahead. This is what should be uniting us. And as we travel in our tour, finding more and more people who are saying that. And while we spent time at Baker's Bar, you know, it could have been cheers for all I know, because everybody knew their names. That's what they were demanding: a government that makes their lives better, that does the things collectively that we can't do individually. And look, as we went into Flint, I was expecting, gotta be honest, as we were pulling into Flint, I'm expecting things to be horrible. I'm expecting the craters in the ground. I'm expecting bombs fallout. I'm expecting a whole bunch of horrible, when the reality is Flint's just like any other city we've been to. There are some good places. There's some bad places. There's some places that are thriving, doing really well. There's some places that need attention and need investment. And part of what I've been saying all along is, well, the parts that are doing well have always been doing well because we pay them attention. The parts that are struggling, they've been struggling for a while because, well, we haven't been paying attention. This is where government policy plays. This is where the investment that I think President Biden and this administration is starting to look at and starting to move us in that direction. So, you know, as we spend time here in Flint and at the fabulous Flint Farmers Market, which I got to tell you, loved walking around this. It reminded me of being a kid growing up in Cleveland, where we used to go down to the West Side Market and, you know, all of the ethnic foods and all of the opportunity to get fresh produce. And it was kind of a little walk back in time, but a fabulous, fabulous sight. And Alice in Wonderland Day. Again, community organizations doing things together in public space, not what I was expecting, not what I was expecting at all. And everyone we talked to, from the person who drove us over there to the person who walked us around, kept saying the same thing. Things are coming back. There's a sense that this is going to be a thriving area. People are coming back into the city, even on Saturday and Sunday. People are, well, they're engaged and active. And this, I got to tell you, this seems to be the message in the places that we're going. Seems to be the message that, you know what? We were once this powerful manufacturing industry where, you know, we made this or we made that, and this created good, solid working class jobs and gave us that Leave It to Beaver, Norman Rockwell kind of image of the past. But things got really rough. But we're making our way out of it. And that sense of we're making our way out of it, we're rebuilding, we're looking to the future with some hope and opportunities, that, again, I come back to this administration. Policy-wise, is moving. Investment in infrastructure, reshoring manufacturing, bringing those jobs back, and yes, talking about how workers can share in that prosperity by joining and forming unions. To me, that's the secret sauce. That's the simple stuff that we should be doing, we should be demanding, we should be standing together and fighting on. And so far, that's what we've been finding. So today on the program from Flint, we're going to talk with Dana Nessel, also a young candidate who I got to tell you, I think someday going to be president. Seems like a brilliant kid. Also going to share some thoughts on going to the Gerald Ford Library and, you know, maybe some back and forth on what we found while we visited there. And I'll tell you some surprising things for me, so you're not going to want to miss that. You miss any portion of our programs, make sure you check out our podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. Also love to hear your thoughts, questions, comments. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back here from the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour. I'm Rick Smith. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
This is the best of The Rick Smith Show. We're taking a break during the holiday season, wishing you and yours the very best holiday ever. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1845. That was the day that the first Industrial Congress of the United States met in New York City. People interested in the problems facing working people, including long hours, low pay, and unsafe working conditions, gathered together. The labor movement was just beginning in this country. These were the years when the early trade unions were formed. Women played an important role in the early labor movement. Female textile mill workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts, began to organize for the 10-hour day. In 1844, they established the Lowell Female Labor Reform Association. Their goal was to improve working conditions in the mills. The Lowell Women's Group sent a representative to New York for the Labor Congress. Another important development of the fledgling labor movement was the establishment of labor presses. George Henry Evans, a labor newsman, also attended the Congress. He was the editor of a series of U.S. labor papers, starting with the Workman's Advocate in 1829. He had come to the United States from England, where he had been involved in the trade labor movement. He also attended the Labor Congress. The meeting recommended the formation of three organizations. First was an industrial brotherhood for workers, including farmers. The second was an industrial sisterhood for women workers. The third was a group for friends of labor. The Congress met again in New York in 1847, then again met in Chicago in 1850. These early efforts to establish larger labor groups did not gain much traction, but they began to lay the framework for workers to come together to discuss their challenges and imagine how they could work together to bring about change for better wages, shorter hours, and safer working conditions. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Are you tired of
Think Tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com, here at the Flint Farmers Market. Enjoying our time talking with folks. I'm joined by the producer, the professor, my road companion, Brett Pransky. Brett, how are we doing today?
We're doing great, Rick.
So what do you think of the farmers market? I mean, we've spent some time walking around. This, I got to tell you, I had such a great time here.
Yeah, this place is fantastic. I mean, it's exactly what you would want to see in a community that's, you know, that's really on its way back. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff here. There's a lot of great people, a lot of great products, and it's been a great day.
Now, the message that we were thinking about as we were coming here, and it keeps popping into my head, Flint. The first thing you think about is the water. The mm-hmm. first thing you think about is, you know, the infrastructure that's failing. The first thing you think about is, you know, Michael Moore's book and the pictures of the GM plant that, you know, looked like someone bombed it. So my mind was in this place that's what I was expecting to see. I haven't seen that. Now, I'm not saying it's not here, but I haven't seen that as the overall picture here.
Right. I mean, you know, national news, whenever national news spends any time talking about this area of the country, that's usually the picture they paint is, you know, the idea that the area is, you know, has kind of fallen apart over the years and so on. But when you come here, when you actually, you know, come to areas like this, which is why we're doing what we're doing, you know, because while we're here to talk about working class issues, we're here to talk about, you know, what we need to do in order to put us, you know, keep us going in the right direction with an election coming up. You know, what I'm finding is in a lot of places, we're kind of undoing some mythology about some of these parts of the country, too.
Yeah. Now, everywhere you look here, and this is kind of this, everywhere you look, construction everywhere. And I was waiting to see the big, you know, 15-foot Joe Biden signs going, I did this, because it's the reinvestment that we're seeing across the country that, you know, they're getting investments. There are things that are being done. And the sense that I get from the people that we've talked to is that this is an area on the rise.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, as much as what we might get annoyed by, you know, by traffic cones and barrels and all these kinds, what we need to understand is where we're seeing these things happen. We're seeing new things be created, you know, from the old. We're seeing jobs. We're seeing people who don't just have jobs, but have jobs that are paying living wages. We're seeing, you know, family sustaining jobs, you know, being created, you know, all over the community.
Now, the energetic and patient woman who showed us around and drove us around there, you know, she, you know, grew up in the area. And one of the things that stuck with me with what she said was there are now people coming back into the city. There are now people who are coming to the downtown area. There are now activities going on. In fact, you know, there's the Alice in Wonderland event going on. Not quite sure why. I think it was some kind of an Alzheimer's event. But there are people coming back into the area that she says she, well, in her life, never saw before.
Yeah, that was something that we heard a number of different times. You remember we talked with one of the folks who was actually on duty, you know, part of the maintenance staff, you know, who said the same kind of thing, is that, you know, downtown is now being used and utilized by the population as a destination, as a place to go to, you know, to do things and spend time with your family. And this is something that a lot of people are saying is a relatively new occurrence, or at least one that, you know, has been gone for quite some time.
Now, I'm sure the area, as she said, you know, it's got some of its problems. Like any place, it's got its problems. But you can address that. And I think this comes back to what we've been talking about. You bring back manufacturing, you bring back those jobs that were lost from that area that created the prosperity of the past. I think you can move forward again. And I forget, you know, who we were talking to, but they were saying, look, you know, you give people the chance, you know, they're going to lead productive lives. If they have nothing to look forward to, what do you think you're going to get out of them?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what we're noticing here with this return and this kind of revitalization of the downtown area is it's kind of a return to community. people being with people. And again, you know, we think about it as a rather simple concept, but you know, there was a pandemic, and you know, many of us were shut away and shut in. And I think what we're beginning to see, and while you know the pandemic still exists and these problems still exist, we're seeing people who are you know, getting back to that sense of community, which is really important if we're gonna go where we need to go.
Now, the other part of it is, and we had another gentleman give us a ride and show us some things as well. And the thing that I took from him, and I wanted to spend a minute on this, because I got the sense, you know, he didn't necessarily agree with us on everything, but was in this world of, you know, things need to happen to make lives better. And the political parties need to work together, and that he agreed with my position that it's our fault, the working people's fault, because, you know, we've been so divided that if we were to come back together and demand the things that we talk about all the time, the jobs, the infrastructure, the education, the healthcare, all of those things, that if we would demand that, if we could come together and demand that get done, we'd be a much more united country.
Yeah, I remember, you know, during that ride, he was very careful not to profess any kind of political lean or affiliation. He was very careful to distance himself from that. And again, some of this probably has to do with being in a service related field, and you know, you don't want to serve your customers by arguing with them. But one thing that he was very open about was this fact that we need to get back to a position where we work together. We need to get back to a place where we need to drop the nonsense. I can't remember exactly what word he used, but we need to drop the nonsense and start getting things done and start working together. That the division itself was, you know, was something that was really frustrating for him. You know, without declaring that he was on either side of it, or that he agreed with one side of this or another side, or, you know, really this idea that there are sides and that those sides are so separate from each other and that they don't come together. This was a frustration that he shared pretty openly.
And it's a frustration that we have. I mean, to be honest, I'm in this spot. I'm going, you know, we all kind of lead similar kind of lives and the same kind of struggles and all of that. And we should be striving for solutions to that, not by what tears us apart. And yet more and more, my view of we all have the same destination in mind is being challenged by people who just want to burn things down and want to tear things apart.
Right. We talk all the time on the show about how we take those kind of left-right divisions, and we kind of give them a quarter turn. And when you give them a quarter turn, now you're not looking at left-right, you're looking at up-down, which is what we focus on, which is what we're all about. And what I find is, regardless of the political ideologies of the people we may run into, except for, you know, some of the people who are way out there on the fringe, like the woman with the Biden flag in Erie that we met, and, you know, she completely off her rocker. But most people, you know, agree that the issues are up down, that the things that bring us together are far greater than the things that divide us. And they're very quick to go there when you give them the opportunity. So when you come into these conversations, again, without, you know, professing that, you know, I'm 100% of this or 100% of it, if you're willing to meet people where they are and talk about the issues up down instead of left right, progress can be made.
Yeah. Now, while we were here, I wanted to try one of the Kegel dogs. I think that's what they're called. I wanted to, but I couldn't. Because the place we did stop to eat, fabulous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's one thing that's been a theme of the trip so far is really good food. And again, you know, just as I said in a previous episode, and it's turned out to be true, it's always the places that you know, we don't go to chain restaurants. We don't go to the place you're going to see in every city across America. We go to the places that are family owned, that have been there forever. And every time we just get the most fantastic food.
No, it's just been. In fact, you were saying you're about ready to leave the wife and got a new wife in Erie. I understand.
Well, I tell you what, I think that might upset her a little bit. But let's put it this way: there is a server and a cook at Dabrowski's in Erie, who, you know what, if I wasn't spoken for, all right. She'd be in trouble right now because I'd be chasing her around. It's the most spectacular food that I've had in a very long time.
I don't think you'd have to chase her far. I mean, the food, the potato pancakes I had there were fabulous. But, you know, these are the kind of things that can bring us back together, I think. And when you talk about these things, I think it's important to remember that the things that unite us are much, much greater than the things that tear us apart.
They really are. They really are.
Got to take a quick break right here. When we come back, we're going to talk with Dana Nessel, the Attorney General here in the state of Michigan. Get some of her thoughts on what's going on, why this campaign is so important, and what the major issue of this era is. And as I keep saying, it's democracy. Do we believe in democracy or don't we? All of the other issues seem to be almost second in this moment. Quick break, right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1899. That was the day union miners in Mount Olive, Illinois, began commemorating Miners' Day. Every year, thousands came into town for a parade, music, and speeches. Mount Olive was the site of the only union-owned cemetery in the United States, established by UMWA Local 728 in the aftermath of the Verdun Massacre. A year before to the day, striking miners had been killed in a shootout with company goons attempting to herd scabs into the mines in Verdun, Illinois. But, as Mother Jones biographer Elliot Gorn notes, the train never unloaded its cargo and the company was forced to settle. The union hoped to erect a gravesite monument commemorating those miners who had been killed at Verdun, but they were refused by those who considered the fallen miners to be murderers and not martyrs. That's when the United Mine Workers established the Union Miners Cemetery, and on this day, 10,000 turned out for the union's memorial ceremony. The United Mine Workers unveiled a monument dedicated to the fallen Verdun miners E.W. Smith, Joe Gitterly, Ernest Kramer, and E.F. Long. The day was filled with parades, music, laying of wreaths, and speeches. Haymarket widow and radical activist Lucy Parsons was among the speakers. In his book, Death and Dying in the Working Class, Michael Rosnow notes that her presence drew a direct connection between the fallen miners and the Haymarket martyrs, cut down while advancing the cause of labor. Thousands traveled to Mount Olive every year for celebrations, including Eugene V. Debs, miners' leader John Mitchell, and Mother Jones. In 1923, Mother Jones asked to be buried with her boys, noting they are responsible for Illinois being the best organized labor state in America.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
The problem with our so-called free market is that it's not free for you and me. It's largely controlled by monopolies, which are free to inflate prices just because they can, letting gougers gleefully extract unwarranted monopoly profits from us. This milking of consumers by tightly consolidated industries is propelling today's surging price hikes. Brand name corporations claim they're being forced to mark up price tags just to cover rising costs for raw materials, labor, transportation, etc. But in a competitive marketplace, they'd have to eat much of those increases by taking a bit less in profits. Indeed, monopolies are now raising prices simply to squeeze even greater profits from hard-hit consumers, a game of corporate greed that socks America with more inflation. Consider diapers. A year ago, Procter & Gamble announced that the pandemic was driving up its production costs, forcing it to raise prices for its Pampers brand. At the time, it had just posted a quarterly profit of $3.8 billion, so P&G could easily have absorbed a temporary rise in its costs. But instead of holding the price to ease their customers' economic pain, the conglomerate used a global health crisis to justify upping diaper prices. 6 months later, P&G's quarterly profit topped $5 billion. And in that same quarter, P&G spent $3 billion to buy back shares of its own stock, a Wall Street manipulation that artificially bloats the wealth of top executives and other big shareholders. In short, P&G used the excuse of inflation to inflate the price of their diapers, then use the extra money it extracted to inflate the value of its stock to benefit rich shareholders. This is Jim Hightower saying, well, couldn't consumers just switch to Huggies, the brand sold by P&G's main competitor? No, for it's a co-monopolist, having also goosed up its prices.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Flint, Michigan, as we continue on our Working Class Heroes radio tour, brought to you by the good folks at American Family Voices and our friends at Courier Newsroom. Remember, you can follow us along at TheRickSmithShow.com. Find out where we've been, where we're going. Also, contact me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Very, very fortunate to have the Attorney General here at the great state of Michigan sit down with us. Dana Nessel has come to the farmer's market here in Flint to share some thoughts with us, some ideas. Dana, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So walk me through a crazy, crazy moment we're in.
Oh my gosh, I don't know where to start. We are in a very strange period of time for sure. And I mean, when I ran for office in 2018, there was a lot of stuff that I wanted to get done, but there were so many things I didn't see coming. You know, I didn't think I'd be serving during a time where we had a once-in-a-century global pandemic, and I didn't see all the risks involving domestic terrorism. Right, my attorneys are in court, well, not today, it's Saturday, but yesterday this week, pursuing the Wolverine Watchmen, who, of course, tried to kidnap and assassinate Governor Whitmer. And I didn't see so many threats to our system of elections and all the work that we'd have to do in 2020 just to make sure that the guy who received 154,000 more votes than the other guy in our state received our 16 electoral votes. So it's been a challenging time. But, you know, we try to walk and chew gum at the same time and you know, do regular things, protecting workers, protecting seniors, protecting consumers, all the things that I ran for initially.
All the things that we used to do that nobody knew you used to do. Until
right.
Till now the Attorney General becomes the most important position in all of politics.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy. In sort of regular times, you could focus more on these other issues, but we have so many different issues now that we've never had to deal with before. But we're trying to do all those things simultaneously, and I think we've done a good job at it, that at the Michigan Department of Attorney General.
Yeah, well, let's get into some of the boring work that you normally do, like helping people clean up their records and get jobs and lead good lives. I know you just came from an event to help people who've had, you know, criminal pasts clean up their record so that they can, you know, they did their time so they can move on and lead productive lives. That's the kind of work I want an attorney general working on.
So what we've seen, and I've had this many years as both as a prosecutor, as a defense attorney, that, you know, people who have old convictions on their record, it really stymies their ability to move on in life. And so not only does it really limit what they can do from the perspective of employment or in education or even housing where they can live, but it leads to recidivism. It leads people to reoffend because they don't have those opportunities. So, you know, killing, I don't know, two birds with one stone. I mean, on one hand, you know, when you help people get their convictions cleared up and expunged, you are giving them these opportunities. They pay more in taxes. They pay for their child support, which sometimes the state has to pick up the tab if they don't pay. And if they do reoffend, we're talking about $35,000 to $40,000 a year to lock them up. And so, you know, I participated heavily in this clean slate package of bills to make it easier to get people's records expunged. I put together an entire department at our office, and now we go all around the state assisting people, not, you know, dozens or hundreds, I mean, thousands and thousands of people, getting their old records cleared up so that they can move on in their life, get better jobs, and better support their families.
All important stuff. Now, the president has just come out and he's pardoned a bunch of people who've had marijuana convictions. Now, this is federal. That's got to trickle down to the state level because most drug crimes, you know, especially on marijuana front, aren't those mostly state offenses?
They are. And we were already doing that in Michigan. So I actually drafted the legislation that ended up passing to make it very easy for people with misdemeanor marijuana convictions to get those expunged, much easier than other kinds of crimes because it's not even illegal anymore. So I thought we should treat that differently than we treat all other crimes that still, of course, are, you know, either misdemeanors or felonies under the criminal code. So, you know, we've done that. You know, my view is on marijuana is, you know, basically we just have a lot of problems right now with violent crime. And, you know, misdemeanor marijuana cases, just it's not worth our time, you know, trying to pursue those cases. And it's something that, you know, we haven't seen a correlation between marijuana usage and violent crime.
Now, my conservative listeners, you hit on a point that they're fixated on. You know, violent crime is through the roof and that Democrats are weak on violent crime.
Well,
weak on violent crime?
I would suggest that's not true at our department at all. In fact, we did a lot to expand the number of units that we have in our criminal division. So we have all kinds of new units that we never had before. First of all, we have some of the biggest investigations and prosecutions in the country here in Michigan in terms of sexual assault. So our clergy abuse investigation, seven dioceses, we have right now, we charged 11 clergy members who had committed, you know, many of them, dozens of acts of sexual assault against children. And, you know, we're in trial right now, so we have a lot of those folks that we've prosecuted. We haven't lost any of those cases yet. Boy Scouts of America, we identified about 3,000 cases of sexual abuse, 3,000 victims in Michigan alone, and we're pursuing those cases right now. We have a brand new unit in our office, first of its kind in the country, the Organized Retail Crime Unit. And what it is, it's those large-scale, you know, operations that really rise to the level of, you know, these are criminal syndicates, right? And, you know, in Michigan alone, $1 billion a year they steal from small businesses and from, you know, big box stores. And we're going after, you know, these heads of these criminal organizations. Well, I testified to, you know, enable more time for those individuals when they get apprehended. But you see millions of dollars that are walking out the door. And what happens is for local communities, it means those businesses have to shut down because the loss, the theft is too great. Yeah. And also as consumers, it increases the amount of these products for everybody. So we're going really hardcore after those individuals. And, you know, I will say this. In terms of these gun-related offenses, first of all, working very hard to make sure that people who don't, who aren't legally permitted to have guns, don't have them. And I'm talking about people who are, you know, convicted felons, people who are currently on parole or probation, who shouldn't have those weapons. But what I'd really like to see done in Michigan is, you know, I'm running against a guy who thinks that under the Second Amendment, this is his viewpoint, that there are no restrictions under the law permitted of any kind at all, whatsoever. That means anybody has any kind of gun, anytime, anywhere, under any circumstance. That's insane.
So hold on, let me walk this to the next conclusion. So I can have anything?
That's right, you can have anything.
So I can have a howitzer, I can have a, you know, stealth bomber, I can have a nuclear bomb, I can have anything?
Well, that's his interpretation of the Second Amendment. You know, I support the Second Amendment, but with certain restrictions, of course.
Well, this is where I come down. Everyone believes in gun control to a certain extent. Everyone, there's a line. For me, it's just where we draw that line. Do we want people having AR-15s on every street corner? And I don't. And I don't think the majority of people do. I'm not a gun grabber. I own a gun. But there's a point at which, you know, keeping the public safe from people who I don't think should have guns is something we should be fighting for.
Yeah, and I've done these school safety tours where I go all around the state of Michigan and assist schools in identifying whatever their weaknesses are. You know, do they need better door locks? You know, do they need more surveillance equipment, more cameras? Do they need to make sure that there are locks on doors so that you can't even enter to the lobby without talking to somebody? And we can do all that, but we can turn our schools into prisons.
Yeah, that's just sounds horrible.
But right now, an 18-year-old can go out and buy, you know, a deadly weapon and then go to school later on that day. We know most 18-year-olds are still in school. So if you can't buy a beer when you're 18, you know, my personal opinion is you shouldn't be able to buy a deadly weapon until you turn 21. And so it's things like that, right, that just seem common sense that we can change things so that we don't have 18-year-olds going into their schools and killing a bunch of their classmates.
I got to tell you, though, I'm listening to you going around the schools and figuring out how to lock them down. I know I'm older. I'm getting older every day, but I remember when the schools were open. I remember when all the doors were open and it was a place where people came and you encouraged kids to spend more time at. Now we're shutting them out. My kids, you know, they can only get there 5 minutes before the class starts. And it's this kind of restrictive place now. And it's because of this issue, which drives me insane.
Well, you know, when we were in school, and I'm not going to guess at your age, I'm going to guess we're probably similarly situated. Are you a Gen Xer like I am?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm 55. So I throw myself right in there.
So we, you know, we had tornado drills. You know, I remember having a drill. I still remember this when I was a freshman in high school. And, you know, we were worried, of course, about, you know, nuclear war.
Yep, hiding under the desks in the Catholic school because Catholic school desks protected you from nuclear fallout.
Somehow. And now my kids, I mean, I can't tell you how many times my kids, you know, they're sophomores now in college. But when they were in high school, used to text me from their locked up classroom, say, I don't know what time I'm going to be let out. There was a rumor of somebody having a gun in we're all locked in. We didn't have that when we were kids. And I think a big part of it, I think, is because we did not permit assault weapons to be sold legally, except for, of course, to law enforcement. And I think the thing that we have to think about is, you know, first of all, I'm a huge promoter of having law enforcement have all the things they need to be able to do their jobs, right? And to make sure, of course, that we are encouraging people to enter law enforcement because they have the right pay scale and they have proper benefits. I mean, good retirement benefits and you know, good medical benefits and all the rest. But they're outmanned, you know, on the streets. They're outgunned because they don't oftentimes have access to the same caliber of weapons that, that you know,
and
criminals on the streets do.
Didn't we learn that lesson back in the 90s in Los Angeles with that debacle back then? I thought we learned that. Why do we have to keep going back and relearning things we should already know?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. But another thing that we're trying to do, you know, I mean, we can be tough on crime, but also smart on crime. So I have a program, first of its kind in the country, very proud of it, called the Job Court. And what we're doing is starting it off in Wayne County, in Marquette County, and here in Genesee County. And I'm working with the county prosecutors and the county sheriffs. So it's a program where we take these low-level offenders when they first get into the system, not your violent offenders, but people who, you know, maybe they're not violent now.
Made a mistake.
But maybe in the future, if we don't set them on the right course, something bad could happen in the future. And it's a diversion program where we put them right into job training and right into a job. And, you know, a lot of these are union jobs. They're good paying, good benefits. And we provide them with some wraparound services. They need help with transportation. They need help with child care. We try to assist them. I think we're going to have a 0% recidivism rate. I think none of those people are going to end up reoffending, because the thing that I found as a longtime prosecutor is this. The most dangerous person is a person who's got nothing to lose.
Absolutely.
So we're giving these folks something to lose.
Absolutely.
And my hope is, I mean, these good union jobs, and you know, it's great. All the unions are working with us on this. You know, they need people, and they're excited to start training these folks, to start helping these folks find a different path. And what I think is going to happen to these folks is that, you know, they're going to end up being good tax-paying members of the community, and we're not going to have to support them in any way, shape, or form. Instead, you know, they're going to be folks that are out there contributing to our tax base, not costing our tax base.
No, you're singing to the choir here, because I'm that kid. You know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and you know, there was no hope or opportunity in our area. And it was that union card I carry in my wallet that I now live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers. My kids will never see the poverty and desperation that I grew up with. They'll never know the insecurity. They'll never know the kind of pain and suffering that culture went through. So to hear you talk about it and understand that is really important to have an elected official understand it.
Yeah, and you know what we've seen, you know, we have Vocational Village, for instance, in Michigan Department of Corrections. And it's funny, I was talking to my friends at the Carpenters and Millerites, and I mean, they have, you know, where they have that training program right there in the facility, 0% of the people who participate in this program reoffend. 0%. That's unheard of. But, you know, man, being a carpenter or millerite, these are good paying jobs.
Yep.
And what happens? They get out there. First of all, they're so busy working, they don't have time to go gangbanging or doing anything else. But also, they're making really good money.
As you said, you know, they've got something to lose. And again, I can attest to that, because I'm right there with you. I had some problems early on as a younger man. I got that job, and you know, I've been an upstanding citizen ever since. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Dana Nessel. She's Michigan's Attorney General. You want to check out her website, DanaNessel.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Now, as a labor guy, I know you're the top cop of the state. And one of the things I got to get to is one of the things that I'm thrilled that you do and our Attorney General in my state of Pennsylvania has done a great job of going after people who, the real criminals, in my view. And we've talked about some people who commit crimes, but I think the real criminals sit in our corporate boardrooms and sit in our employers who steal from their workers, who misclassify their workers. I think the Rand Corporation did a study that said, you know, about $45 trillion in wealth has been stolen from the working class. I love the fact that there are attorney generals out there who are fighting for the little guy. Tell me about the work that you're doing here in Michigan.
Sure. Well, one of the things that we did as soon as I got into office is we set up the payroll fraud enforcement unit. And what we do is this, you know, anybody can make a complaint to us. And, we look at people who have been ripped off, workers who have been ripped off for their tips or their overtime. Lots of folks who, if they go to one job to the next, they don't get their last paycheck. And a lot of people, as you suggested, who are misclassified by their workers, by their employers or their contractors. And they know that they are employees, right? They only work for them. They're not out there, you know, with, a private company that's going out and doing a whole bunch of different jobs. They're just working for that one particular contractor, that one particular employer, and yet they are being classified as an independent contractor. They're provided a 1099, so they have to pay their own taxes, and they are not getting the benefits that they are entitled to, medical benefits and retirement benefits, which they're entitled to under the law. And they're also robbing the state of Michigan because
Absolutely. They're
not paying taxes for their employee. And you know, it injures employees in all kinds of different ways, including things like workers' comp that they're not entitled to because they were an independent contractor. So what we do is we work, you know, we work, first of all, with the unions because they know what employees are getting ripped off. But we work with everybody out there. And, you know, you'd be surprised. With an employer, sometimes all it takes is a friendly call or a nice little letter that's got our logo on it and our seal from the Department of Attorney General to say, we think you may be misclassifying your worker. You might want to take a look. And boom, like within a week, oh, yeah, no, we got that worked out. Sorry about that.
Hey, we see you.
And the problem is when you don't have enforcement of laws like this, then really what's the incentive for these employers to obey the law? And so county prosecutors, we've got 83 county prosecutors in Michigan, but they don't do this kind of work. Only the attorney general does this kind of work. And so we've actually gone after, I mean, we've prosecuted employers when they have ripped off their employees.
That's what I want to hear. I want to hear them going to jail for a change, because you never hear that. You know, I've often said if I wanted to kill somebody, I would just hire them, because we never seem to hold employers responsible when they're negligent or criminal in this view. But you know, we're at election time, and this is where this kind of moment is important. And I look at the last president that we had. The person that he put in charge of looking into wage theft was someone who was accused of wage theft.
Exactly.
We now have someone who's aggressively pursuing people who are committing wage theft. And I look at the same kind of thing here. I listen to your story. I got to wonder about your opponent. You know, any thoughts here about how they would look at wage theft?
Well, I mean, you know, these are folks that, you know, support the right to freeload. Right. These are people that have made their disdain for unions known for a very long time. I mean, you know, I'm a big supporter of unions. I'm a big supporter of labor. You know, it's so critical in terms of maintaining a society where you have the ability for people to, you know, not, you know, fall into poverty. I mean, the unions are what built the middle class. We say it all the time, right?
Right.
But it's true. And whether it's worker safety laws, whether it's the fact that people get to have the weekend off, whether it's, you know, child labor laws, I mean, you know, unions did all that. And that's why, you know, I support unions. They support me. And my opponent, I mean, he is a guy that, you know, I know that all these initiatives that we've been talking about, they would all fall by the wayside in the event that he was in office. And, you know, he just took a picture the other day. This is not related so much to workers' rights, but it does relate to something else that's very important to me, which is uplifting our public school system and our educators. You know, he just took a picture with him and Betsy DeVos and bragged about, you know, he supports her, she supports him.
That should be a disqualifier right there. Because look at where we are right now. I just saw a study, you know, thing my friend Heather Long at the Washington Post, you know, put out a piece that said we're down like almost 400,000 teachers than we had before the pandemic. Education is under assault. And I would say billionaire Betsy and her clan are a big part of that.
They demonize our educators, you know. And I always think about sort of the story of the trajectory of my life, right? You know, my parents were the children of very poor immigrants who had fled World War II and, you know, couldn't read, couldn't write, had no good skill set. And yet my parents, you know, they went to the Detroit public schools And they got a good education. They went on. They both, you know, worked their way through other things later. My mom became a teacher. She's a MEA member, a retired MEA member at this point. You know, she's a special ed teacher. My dad was an accountant. But they could come from these incredibly poor families, and they could lift themselves up because they received this, you know, world-class public education. And, you know, I think that people like Betsy DeVos recognize that the only way that you can have folks like her, the billionaires of the world, succeed is to make sure that you have people not be permitted to get a good public school education. And that way, they don't even participate in democracy. And I wrote a brief on this in a case. It was a big case in Michigan a few years back called the Right to Read case, Right to Literacy case. And it had to do with when former Governor Rick Snyder had an emergency manager come in and take over the Detroit public schools. And boy, they weren't providing anything for these kids. The kids still had to go to school every day, but they didn't have books and they didn't have teachers and they didn't have, you know, the conditions in the classrooms were horrible and they weren't learning anything. And, you know, part of why I supported those kids was to say, listen, these kids, it's not just that you're never going to give them a fighting chance in life to do anything if they can't read or write. But more than that, they'll never be able to participate in democracy because people who don't read and write frequently don't vote. And so part of, I think, this whole scheme by the billionaires of the world is to make sure that people don't have the ability to vote, because then they don't recognize how to make their own lives better, and they don't recognize the billionaires of the world, like Betsy DeVos, are making their lives worse and taking advantage of them. So, you know, it's all really tied together. But I think that's what we've tried to focus on since I've been in office. I was the first Democrat in that office in over 16 years. And really trying ways to lift up working people. And we have so many different things that we've done. You know, Adopt and Amend. I don't know if you've heard of this. It's kind of a Michigan phenomenon. But it's something where the Republican legislature, what they've done is when the people bring forward a ballot initiative that the legislature refuses to do, and we had a few back, in 2018 where this happened, you know, we had one that was had to do with paid sick leave for workers. And we had one that had to do with a working, you know, wage, like a living wage, a $15 minimum wage. And for food servers, you know, they could be $3 an hour.
And then
the
sub-minimum wage, right?
Sub-minimum wage. And so lifting them up out of poverty. And so what the Republican majorities in the legislature did is very clever. They passed that. And then they totally gutted it later so that the voters would never get a chance even to weigh in on this. Well, you know, we worked with outside organizations who sued the legislature, and we got a court to say that is an illegal and unconstitutional practice. And because of that, as soon as we work out some of the appeals, I know we're going to be able to lift people up and make sure they get that paid sick leave.
But it shouldn't be that difficult, should it? I mean, the will of the people should happen. And I know we've got an election coming up, and you're on the ballot. And I'm hoping for, you know, people to vote for people like you, because we need people who are going to defend democracy. So last question I've got for you. You know, we hear this frame, democracy's under attack. Is that hyperbole, or are we really under attack?
No, we're there. We're there now. And, you know, when you think about, you know, what the future is going to be for our state here in Michigan and all across the country, it's about people getting out to vote this time and making sure that we have the right people in office. And when I say the right people, I mean the pro-democracy party, which honestly right now is just the Democrats. I'm sorry to say that, but it's true. You know, myself and our Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson, I mean, we had to work so hard in 2020 just to make sure the person who got the most votes in our election, you know, won our electoral votes and became the president of the United States because of it. And you have so many efforts to subvert the election. I mean, I had to handle case after case after case, whether it was Sidney Powell, you know, the Kraken coming in and trying to decertify our election. We beat her. Attorney General Ken Paxton from Texas, who sued us to the United States Supreme Court to try to decertify our election. And to which I said to him, you know, Ken Paxton, who invited you here to Michigan? Stay in your lane. You know who voted for you here? Nobody. Absolutely no one. Stick to disenfranchising voters in your own state. Don't come to mine. So we beat him. But my own opponent, he filed those Antrim County lawsuits. He worked with the Trump administration to do it. He was in Washington, D.C. on January 6, 2021, working with the Trump campaign. And he is still trying to decertify the results of the 2020 election right now. He's got a case that's pending before the Michigan Supreme Court where he's still trying to convince everybody to overturn the lawful election of President Biden 2 years later.
How crazy is that?
And he is running to be the person who defends the will of the voters, even though he has specifically said that he's going to throw out all the tabulators. He's not going to allow any votes to be counted after midnight of the day of the election. He wants to suppress people's votes, and he wants to undermine the will of voters. And I'm fighting to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Dana, I appreciate you sharing some time with us. I hope the good people of Michigan make the right choice. DanaNessel.com, the website. We'll get links out on social media. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. I'm going to take a quick break back here from the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour. Make sure you tell us what you think.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media
News.
App.
ABC News.